Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say the menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac killer. Betsy Gebhardt has details.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and today we're going to be talking about Zodiac Killer. It's a new killing that just happened. And joining is Mike Morford and Mike Butterfield. How are you doing tonight?
Doing great.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the Sherry Jo Bates case. Did Zodiac kill her or not?
Well, that's an easy question, Mike. Do you want to take that one?
Yeah, that depends on who you ask. You know, the Sherry Jo Bates segment of the Zodiac mystery is a really interesting one because, you know, her murder happened, you know, 6 hours south of San Francisco in Riverside, California, and it happened in 1966 before there ever was a Zodiac killer. You know, her murder is a little bit different than most of the murders that Zodiac did, you know, with the exception of Barry Essa, where he used a knife and she was killed by a knife, stabbed, and almost decapitated. But what's really interesting about her case is there was a series of letters after her murder that, you know, were linked later on by the state's top handwriting expert, Sherwood Morrill, very respected handwriting analysis guy in his field, and he linked that writing to Zodiac later on. And just in looking at the language of the letters, you know, that were sent in the Sherry Jo Bates case, you know, there's some common words, common phrases, and odd words, you know, like twitch, squirm, you know, shall. Just words that most people don't use very frequently, and some of them are misspelled the same way. And when you take that and you couple it with the fact that that letter writer wanted to take credit, wanted to be published in the paper, the language, the patterns fit, you know, what Zodiac did later on. You know, so when you combine all that, and you combine the desktop writing that was also linked inside the Riverside College Library, I think you take that as a whole, and it tells me and you know, most of the, you know, the investigators that Zodiac wrote letters in her case, wrote the desktop poem that was discovered. That doesn't mean that he killed her, but it means that he may have taken credit for her murder regardless, which is an important clue, because then you can show, you can look at different suspects and say, if this really is his writing, who's in that area that could have wrote these letters? And, you know, so it's still debatable. Some people, you know, still say, well, there's no way he wrote those letters, or some people think he killed, you know, killed Sherry but didn't write the letters. Other people think he wrote the letters but didn't kill her. So there's a lot of debate, and, you know, I think Mike can also touch on some of that as well.
Well, I think, you know, for the listeners, you know, Sherry Jo Bates was killed on October 30th, 1966, and about a month later is when the typewritten confession arrived. Am I right about that, Mike?
Yeah.
And that was typed, and although the envelope had handwriting on it, it was typed, and there were words inside that message that were misspelled the same way that those letters, those words were misspelled in Zodiac letters. Then, about 6 months later, there were three virtually identical handwritten letters sent to the police, to the newspaper, and to the victim's father, which read, "Bates had to die, there will be more." And at the bottom of that letter, there was a little symbol that resembled the letter Z. So that's part of what's fueling a lot of this speculation, in addition to, as Mike mentioned, a message, a poem that was found written on a desktop in the Riverside City College Library, which is near where Bates was killed and where she was believed to have been the night that she was killed. So these three different writings are what handwriting experts have looked at and determined, at least as far as I know, there were at least two experts who agreed that the Zodiac had written those messages. Now, whether or not he was responsible for killing Bates or not, we don't know, but the messages themselves are sort of a link in a way that could indicate that the same person was involved, or at the very least that the Zodiac was inspired by the Bates case, which, if I remember correctly, the Bates case was in a couple of true crime detective magazines at that time, and there was a copy of the confession letter in there and mention of the other writings. And the three virtually identical handwritten letters sent in the Bates case is very similar to the three virtually identical handwritten letters sent at the very beginning of the Zodiac episode a few years later in the Bay Area. So there are legitimate reasons to wonder whether or not the Zodiac was involved. Some of them are based on these expert opinions. And in my case, I think that some of the behavior of the person who killed Bates is similar to the Zodiac's methods. But at the same time, the Zodiac, in March of 1971, sent a letter to the Los Angeles Times, and this was in response to speculation that he was responsible for the Bates murder. And he said, "I do have to give them credit for stumbling across my Riverside activity, but they're only finding the easy ones. There are a hell of a lot more of them down there." And down there was perceived as a reference to Southern California and that there might be more victims. So the Zodiac may have been bragging and taking responsibility for something that he actually did. The Zodiac may have been lying and taking responsibility for something that he actually did, or he may have just been taking responsibility for the murder and the letters and had nothing to do with it whatsoever. I lean towards the idea that the Zodiac may have been involved, but like everything else, when it comes to any suspect in a crime, I just want them to find who did it. So I don't really care whether it was Zodiac or someone else. I just think the evidence indicates that it was Zodiac, and then maybe Mike can talk a little bit about why that has turned out to be the fallback scenario, because the Riverside police have been pursuing a particular suspect for years. A man they claimed knew Sherry Jo Bates and murdered her. And then the DNA that was found at the crime scene in the victim's hand, which I believe consisted of hair and some skin tissue, did not match their suspect. So now we have a scenario where the only evidence available does not match the only suspect the Riverside police has had,
And that leaves us to look for a different suspect now. And I think the Zodiac is the most logical suspect, although it's possible he had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, and you referenced the DNA. You know, there were two sources of DNA, I think, that they collected. One was the hair, and I don't have my notes in front of me. I haven't looked at them in a while, but the other source was a cigarette butt. And I can see the notes. I haven't looked at them in a while, but I can visualize them that they looked at that cigarette butt as well. And I can't remember if both samples didn't match their suspect. But despite the DNA not matching, they still felt this guy was the most likely suspect. And he was a classmate of hers that, you know, they found or suspected that he had been seeing her, and she broke it off with him, and he killed her out of revenge or anger from being, kicked to the curb, so to speak. But the interesting layer comes when that confession letter comes a month after the murder, because the person's giving details in it of what happened and how they disabled her car. And then the Riverside Police Department comes out and says, well, that killer had to be the one that wrote the letter, because there's things in there that only the killer would know, which we know is totally incorrect, because we found articles, you know, a bunch of us have found articles that were posted only a day or so after the murder that describe how the car was disabled. So anybody reading those news articles would have known how the car was disabled and could easily write a confession letter with details of what they did, because it was in the news articles. So
the other question of why would they do that? If, you know, why would somebody write a false confession? But at the same time, the confession itself, you're talking about the police investigating a man who allegedly knew the victim. And in the confession, it claims to have been written by someone who knew her, someone who had been brushed off by her. And while you could interpret that as being, you know, a reference to his particular situation of being dumped by her or whatever, the letter seems to indicate that this was somebody more who had been watching her from afar, or who had some contact with her but was not involved with her. And so I've always kind of gone back and forth between whether or not I believe that that letter is actually written by the killer, whether it contains details that indicate it was written by the killer, and then whether or not what he's telling in that letter is true. Did he really know her? And why would a person who killed her, why would a person who knew her implicate someone who knew her in the crime, when at the same time it would seem to make more sense that a stranger who killed her and didn't want police investigating a stranger might try to implicate someone she knew?
And so, and at the flip side of the coin, the same aspect, why would a stranger need to deflect attention away from himself anyway? Because he's a stranger, he's not going to be thought of. So that's,
and this raises all the weird questions about why would a stranger, because you referred to the her car being disabled. It appeared that someone had disabled her car while she was in the library or somewhere on campus, and then when she came back and it didn't start, according to the letter, he offered her a ride. She accepted when they were walking away is when he had attacked her. Well, why would someone who knew her need to invent this ruse to get her attention? Why couldn't he just walk up and start talking to her? And if he really was trying to get her into his car, how come they never made it to the car? You know, there's all these other questions that go back and forth between making it look like a stranger was involved or making it look like someone who knew her. And I lean towards the stranger idea, but obviously I would accept whatever the truth was, whatever the facts indicate. But when it comes to the suspect that the Riverside Police has been pursuing, I guess it's perfectly possible, it's been done before in other cases, where he might have written that confession letter to deflect attention away from himself towards someone who was a distant admirer or someone else. But I think that it's more likely that maybe that letter could just be a blend of fact or fiction. But then it also raises the possibility of, if some of it's true, did he really know her? And that's where the interesting issues come up with other suspects that have been looked at in the Riverside case and their possible relationship to Zodiac.
Yeah, and with the letters, you know, to me, there's no benefit for, you know, a stranger or somebody that knew her to write that letter. So to me, it almost seems as if it's somebody that has nothing to do with the case at all, without having anything to do with the murder. You know, which makes us look at other people that might not have murdered her, but went on to become the Zodiac. Mm-hmm. And we can start looking at, you know, suspects based on that. And it's not just that, it also goes back to that handwriting analysis, because although the letter was typed, the confessional letter was typed, the envelope wasn't, and, you know, the other letters that came weren't as well, they were printed.
They were written in pencil.
Yeah, and they tried to disguise their handwriting, but, you know, to a handwriting expert, there's certain things that they can still spot. And that writing, as well as the desktop writing, were all linked to Zodiac. So if we take the expert's word on it, you know, we can tell that Zodiac was in that area during that 66 to 67 time frame. So we start looking at suspects in that area and start possibly eliminating suspects from, you know, Northern California that were popular that can't be placed in there. You know, if you look at, you know, people that support Arthur Lee Allen or, you know, Mr. X, you know, as he's been referred to, their supporters have tried to link them to Riverside, saying they went down to races down there, to some of the car races down there, just to try and put them into the mix for being responsible for the Riverside activity. To me, that's a stretch, but nonetheless, there's people that try and link that, because if Zodiac wrote those letters and he was in there, you know, in that area 66 to 67, we can take a lot of suspects off the table, because if they can't be placed in Riverside, then they wouldn't be Zodiac, and that opens up a smaller window of suspects.
Yeah, I think, too, it's important to remember that the Riverside Police Department has had their pet suspect for years, and a lot of people seem to think that the idea that the Zodiac was responsible for this came from reporter Paul Avery, who wrote an article in, I believe, November 1970, releasing or announcing the possible link between the Riverside case and Zodiac, when in reality, the people who started this all in the first place were the Riverside Police Department. They, when they saw what was happening with Zodiac in the news, they sent a letter to the Zodiac investigators, basically saying, look, there are similarities between these two cases, and it's possible the same person could be involved. And so investigators looked into that possibility, and it was the people investigating the Zodiac case and the Riverside Police Department who concluded that it was most likely the Zodiac, whether he'd just written the letters or committed a murder or whatever. But it was after that, when the Riverside Police Department decided that it was just their lone suspect and it had nothing to do with Zodiac. So that's where things have stood for years. So when you talk about, you know, comparing a Zodiac suspect to where he was in Riverside at the time, things like that, a lot of people don't believe that the crimes are connected, so they don't look at it that way. But there's good reason to wonder whether or not Zodiac was involved. It's not just the invention of some journalist.
Yeah, and the interesting backstory to that, to the Riverside's reaching out at all to Zodiac investigators, is because a local man down in that area named Phil Sins was a, you know, an original armchair detective, and he sort of said there's a lot of commonality between the Zodiac letters and these Bates case letters that we had here back in 1966, and he sort of reached out to the Riverside police more than a few times and said, hey, I think you should look at this Bates case letters as being possibly from written by Zodiac, because he saw some of those same things, same use of words, misspellings, stuff like that, wanting to be published in the paper. He said, this sounds just like Zodiac. So it was his urging that finally got the Riverside police to reach out, even though they had their own favorite suspect. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, handwriting experts say, you know, based on this writing, it was the Zodiac. you know, so it's an important connection.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people forget that, you know, when this possible link came up, it wasn't like someone just went, oh, there's some spellings here. It must be the same guy. You know, they actually thought about the crime and how the Riverside case compared to other Zodiac crimes. You know, and in the Riverside case, from what we know and can surmise, it appears that the person disabled her car and then used that as a ruse to gain her trust and take her somewhere to commit the crime. And we know that the Zodiac used a similar ruse in San Francisco when he asked a cab driver to take him to a specific location. And we know that at Lake Berryessa, he lied to them about what was going on. He said that I'm just here to rob you, and that's a ruse of a sort too. So there are reasons to believe that the Zodiac's behavior is similar to the behavior of the person who killed Bates, also in the fact that there's no traditional discernible motive. There's no robbery or rape or sexual assault or any of that. There doesn't appear to be any personal motive, any personal animosity. So we're looking at a similar case in the sense that the Zodiac appears to have killed strangers that he wanted to kill for whatever reason. The fact that certain elements are not the same is not in and of itself enough to dismiss them as being connected, because the Zodiac as a killer had to start somewhere, right? I mean, he had to have his first crime. It's possible that, as many experts say, sometimes a killer's first crime is somehow connected to him. Could it be somebody that he knew or somebody that was in his environment or someone he had encountered in some way? And then later on, he adapted his methods when he became a more proficient or prolific serial killer and started using an identity called Zodiac and whatever. So the fact that you have a woman who's a lone woman who's killed on a college campus with a knife, the fact that that's different in some ways from his other crimes is not indicative that they're not connected. As Mike pointed out, you know, he's using a knife. That's a similarity there. But there's other reasons to look at it as a possible Zodiac crime, not just the fact that he used a knife or whatever. But every serial killer that I know of, that I've studied, their first couple crimes are a little different than their later crimes. You know, Ted Bundy started out breaking into a woman's home and hitting her over the head and stuff, and then he eventually evolved into a killer who's walking up to victims on the street, pretending to have his arm in a cast or his leg and asking for help and things like that. So serial killers adapt. They adapt. They find ways to get what they want and to suit their needs, to fulfill their fantasies. And their fantasies continue to adapt and change and narrow down in specifics to what they really, what really drives them. So, I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, Mike, but I think that I've read enough of what you've written and heard enough of what you said to believe that the fact that there's some similarities or differences in these two cases is not indicative of them being committed by two different people.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There's enough to make it think he could go either way. But one interesting point, when Paul Avery made that link and it went public, you know, Zodiac, who loved the limelight, instead of jumping right on that and saying, oh, you got me, you found my victims down in Riverside, he went silent for, what was it, 6 months?
Yeah.
He didn't make a peep. So
and even
he,
then, kind of grudgingly, right?
Exactly. So I think he was scared. You know, that's the way I take it. If he wanted attention from that connection and he knew he had nothing to do with it, he could just jump right on it, get the attention, and there you go. There's some instant publicity for him, except he went dead quiet. So I think, you know, I think he realized that he had stumbled and they had caught him at least writing the letters, even if he didn't kill her, which would be a major clue. Hey, they know I was in Riverside. I better lay low for a while.
That he was vulnerable. That made him vulnerable because it was a connection to him.
Exactly. So 6 months later, nobody's knocked on his door. He hasn't gotten arrested. So maybe he feels a little bit more comfortable. And he, you know, he finally writes a letter taking credit for it. So those are all the interesting dynamics going on with the Bates case, the letters, and the MO of the letter writer. And then we, you know, that's not even going into Riverside. When we go into the college library, you know, that's where you really start to see more possibilities.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. So some people at the library had some theories about who had killed Sherry Jo Bates, and they tried to communicate that to investigators, and a certain individual came up.
Yeah, I mean, that was Ross Sullivan, and Ross had worked in the library as an assistant. He was a student. He had gone to the college for several years, but one of the students, like, I call him Van Wilder, you know, he goes to school for several years but never seems to graduate, you know, but he's taking all these different courses. He's in and out of a mental hospital, so that's, you know, delays whatever time he's supposed to be there. And meanwhile, he's in the library as an assistant, but he's freaking out the library staff, you know, writing creepy poetry, and things of that nature. You know, they were, I think, afraid of his mental illness. He had schizophrenia. So I think some of the behavior he exhibited made them suspect that he had been responsible for Sherry's murder. But it would be 2 years later, till the writing was linked to Zodiac, that he becomes even more interesting, just based on being in that library.
Well, forgive me if I'm wrong about this, but didn't the letter that was written by one of the women who suspected him state that he had disappeared for a short period of time after the Bates murder?
Yeah, the one librarian that wrote the letter said that he was always in this same spot at a certain time of day, and she said that he always wore the same clothes, and she said that after the murder, he disappeared. He was gone for several days or a couple weeks, whatever it was, and she said if he comes back and he has new clothes on, in her mind, that would make him guilty, that he had killed her and gotten rid of those clothes because they had blood on them or whatever. And sure enough, the next time he showed up a week or two later, he's wearing new clothes. So in her mind, that automatically made her think he might be involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, didn't he supposedly...
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Write some sort of paper about disguising your handwriting or something like along those lines. Am I mistaken about that? Or?
Yeah, it came to light that he had written a report on writing in different styles, which obviously would be something that would be appealing to somebody like Zodiac that's trying to, you know, maybe disguise their handwriting a little bit. He had written creepy poems, which is perfect description of the the desk that was found in the RCC library.
And you should mention that that creepy poem referred to killing a woman.
Yeah, it was a morbid poem that, you know, some people say it sounds like a suicide note, a cry for help for a suicide attempt. I don't believe that at all. I think it's some warped individual that was just doodling while he's supposed to be doing something else, and he was doodling on a desk. And, you know, I don't think he intended it to be found the way it was found and the location that it was found, and I think it was just pure luck that it was found. But nonetheless, it definitely was a creepy poem. That's the kind of stuff that Ross had freaked out the library staff with. And so that's what, in my mind, initially, you know, made me go back and look at him as a suspect, because out of everybody that's ever been mentioned in the Zodiac case, that was the only person I could ever find that I knew for a fact had been in that library. And that's what made me go back and dig into him as a suspect.
Now, the description of him, he looks like the composite sketch. And we talked about this earlier, that he seems like he's a little bigger than some of the descriptions of the Zodiac, but that in some ways might be the result of the angle they were looking at him. Some people were looking at him from a seated position in a car. Some people were looking at him from a second story window looking down. But he matches on several points. What would you say are the top three things that make you think he was the Zodiac, besides being in the library that night and the connection to the writings?
Well, again, I don't.
I shouldn't say that night, by the way. We don't have any evidence.
He just said he was in that library on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple different things. So we know that Ross transferred in mid-67 to Santa Cruz. It said so in the letter that the librarian wrote. Mm-hmm. And that's the last time a Bates case letter was mailed, was mid-67. That's one reason to suspect that he could be him. Also, just the likeness to the sketch, hairline, lips, glasses, facial structure, you know, it's just, you know, a lot of people say, oh, every guy with a crew cut looked like that. And that's just not true. You know, some people had mal pattern baldness or had a crew cut. You know, they didn't match the sketch from so many different points. So to me, in my mind, if it's not Ross, I'll take somebody that looks just like Ross that was also in that library. And to me, that the likelihood of Ross having a twin that was in that library is pretty slim, the chances of that. So in my mind, if we believe Zodiac was in that library and we believe he looked like he looked in that sketch, in my mind, he's the best suspect because he's the only one we can link inside that library, and he just happens to look identical to the sketch. And it turned out that he knew Sherry. His brother wound up marrying Sherry Jo's best friend, Bonnie. So they had a connection there. He knew Sherry on whatever level it was. So we have a connection to her. So when you take all that and combine it, I just think it's, you know, it's pretty powerful. But again, we have, you know, we know he's in that library. We know he looks like the Zodiac sketch. We know he moved north at a certain point that the Bates case letter stopped. But the problem is we just don't have that middle part. We don't have the, you know, he's living in Vallejo and we can prove that. You know, we don't have him living in Napa, or we have reports that, you know, people saw him in San Francisco, but I don't have anything solid to say that for sure. So those are the kind of things that sort of hold me up from, in my mind, just saying he was Zodiac. But until somebody comes forward with another person that can be put in that library, you know, that looks like the sketch, you know, I have to, you know, rest with him being the best suspect in my mind.
Well, and you mentioned his brother. his brother is apparently reluctant to talk about this, but he had an opinion on this, right?
Yeah, so, you know, he had two brothers. The one passed away from cancer back in the, I want to say, the 80s. And his brother was Tim. And Tim told a friend that he said, I'm convinced, or I don't know the exact wording, but he said, I believe my brother's the Zodiac. And at the time, he didn't elaborate on it. And then he wound up moving to Canada and passed away. Mm-hmm. So we don't know why he thought that. Now, his other brother, John, had been living out of state going to college during the Zodiac crimes. And he came back in, I want to say, 76 or so. By then, Zodiac hadn't written in a couple years. He's actually the one that discovered Ross's body. By this point, Ross had presumably, mentally, he had just gone too far to where he couldn't take care of himself. His mental capacity was just was gone, and he was too far into schizophrenia to take care of himself. And he's the one that actually found Ross's body at the living facility where he had been living since 1974.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and answer your question, he's the one that is alive, you know, his other brother's gone, so he's the one that's alive that can, you know, could say, hey, I'd gladly give my DNA, I'm tired of hearing this, my brother's name being mentioned as a Zodiac suspect, what do I have to do to clear it? His response is simply, oh, you guys are crazy, and when he even said, he even called his other brother, Tim, that believed that Ross was Zodiac, called him crazy, said he was crazy too. So rather than want to step forward and say, hey, I'll provide my DNA, let's clear his name, he just brushes it off and says, you are crazy and I don't want anything to do with this.
Well, and that's also the reason that becomes pertinent is because Ross Sullivan was cremated.
Exactly. So, you know, short of his brother not giving DNA, we can hope for a good match that goes into GEDmatch and find out, you know, if there's a relative that comes back closely linked to that family, then we would know if it's likely Ross that was Zodiac, or if it's not, we would know it wasn't. You know, it can be used to exclude people too. So that's why that DNA sample, if it's can be developed and put into GEDmatch into that database, it'll be very important to going a long ways to seeing who can be ruled out as Zodiac and who might be a viable suspect.
Well, and that's for the benefit of the listeners. You're talking about recent efforts to get DNA from Zodiac communications that can be put into genealogy databases, and forensic genealogy can be used to hopefully track down the killer through his relatives.
Yeah,
and go ahead, Mike.
No, I was just going to say, you know, on your point, that's something we've seen over the last several months used time and time again. Almost every week it seems like there's a new case being solved.
Well, that's an interesting point, too, because forgive me if I'm getting this name wrong, but it was Betsy Arzma, is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
The girl who was murdered in a library or in a church. That case had been talked about as a – wait, I'm getting this wrong. It's not – it's Arliss Perry. Arliss Perry was the one that was – she was killed in a church, and that case had always been – discussed as a possible early crime of the same cult that's been blamed for the Son of Sam murders and also for the Zodiac murders. People believe that the same cult was responsible for the Zodiac and Son of Sam murders, and that one of the earliest victims was Arliss Perry. And so it's very telling that when that case was solved through the use of, I believe, DNA, the individual that was identified obviously had nothing to do with any of that, as far as we know. It just turned out to, wasn't it the security guard who found her or something like that?
Yeah, he was the original security guard that had found her body, and he was a suspect early on.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is they had tested his DNA previously, and it didn't match. which for whatever reason they stuck with it, and they used some other technologies that came along recently, and they haven't said that it was the GEDmatch database.
Yeah.
As far as I know, I think they've been pretty tight-lipped about what they did, but they did use some new DNA method to go back to him and confirm that he was the right guy.
And he apparently, his response didn't leave a lot of doubt. He killed himself, if I remember.
Yeah, when they knocked on his door, he shot himself. So it seems like they definitely got the right guy.
Well, that's why I think it's interesting because, you know, you've made it clear, and I believe the same. I feel the same way myself that, you know, we all have theories about what happened in Riverside and who may have been responsible and whether Zodiac was involved. But at the end of the day, I just want to know what happened. I just want to know who did it and for it to be solved. So if they can use that DNA with forensic genealogy to determine that it was Ross Sullivan or it wasn't Ross Sullivan, or whether or not Zodiac was actually connected to that case at all, that's really just what we're looking for. None of us really have any theories that we're married to and are unwilling to let go of. I mean, I know you think Ross Sullivan is a great suspect, but if the DNA came up for somebody else, I'm sure you would accept that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the DNA, if they track the DNA to a suspect the way they've done with the Golden State Killer and other killers, it's not going to be a question of if, you know, there won't be any lingering doubts. They'll know for sure.
Yeah.
And that takes it a step further because now whether or not Sherry was killed by the Zodiac, you know, we know they have DNA evidence in her case. The question is, can they use that DNA they have in the base case to put that into the database and find out who killed her, whether it's Zodiac or not? That should be able to be tried and linked to a suspect. So that's another shoe waiting to drop to see if that's done.
Well, and I think, too, it's going to be a difficult situation because in the Golden State Killer case, they were using semen left behind by the killer. So there's no logical explanation for why your semen was at the scene of a murder. It's not like that's something that's going to happen accidentally. With the Zodiac case, you're talking about DNA taken mostly from stamps or envelopes in the Zodiac case. And people have talked about, you know, maybe the Zodiac had somebody licking stamps for him or whatever, or maybe there's more than one person involved. So even getting some DNA in that case might not answer all the questions. It might point you in the right direction. Hopefully it would solve the case in one way or another. But in the Bates case, you're talking about hair and tissue found in the victim's hand.
Yeah.
And it appears to be, as from everything that I've read, the Riverside Police Department strongly believed that that was left by the killer during the struggle or during some interaction with the victim. So it's going to be very difficult for anybody to explain away how their hair was found in the victim's hand. Unless you're going to say, you know, I was walking by there and brushed my hair a week earlier and she fell down and just happened to touch my hair laying on the ground. Even that's not very plausible. So if they can match that DNA to somebody, that should tell you who did it.
Yeah, and at the very least, it would give them the right trail to go down to say, who does this hair belong to? They find that person, then they can do good old-fashioned police work and maybe rule him out by some other way or say, hey, this guy was originally on our short list of suspects, you know, and now we've got his hair. So there's a couple different ways they can explore that and hopefully lead to somebody. And there's also, we can't forget there was a wristwatch left at the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on how that was preserved, they might be able to get touch DNA or some other kind of new DNA technology that wasn't available earlier. They may be able to get that DNA off of there. There's a new technology called MBAC. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they...
Yeah, that's what they used on the History Channel show.
Exactly. So the MVAC system might be something that could be at play where they'll vacuum that watch and collect any kind of DNA or do touch DNA, whatever they can do. There may be a DNA on that watch that could lead to somebody. They think that definitely belonged to the killer and it came off in the struggle.
For the listeners, that it was found near the body with the wristband torn, apparently, or broken.
Exactly. So that's if they could discover DNA on that and put that into a database, that would be, it would be hard to explain away somebody losing that wristwatch broken like that at the scene.
Well, and that also raises another interesting question, though. What happens when you have a suspect whose DNA doesn't match that DNA? So you have the Riverside suspect, his DNA didn't match what they had found previously. And I wouldn't be surprised if it turned out that his DNA didn't match the DNA on the watch. So at what point do you accept that the person that you suspect is not the killer? If someone's DNA doesn't match the DNA of the hair in that hand, then you have to explain how that hair got there and why it doesn't belong to the killer. And I know that according to some stories, the person who the Riverside police have suspected for years was implicated by an individual who claimed that he had ran into the person that night and he said, oh, I left my watch somewhere or I have to go back somewhere to find something. And this person drove the suspect back to the crime scene and the two of them looked for his watch at the crime scene. And now, I don't know how you can look around that area for the watch and not see the dead body lying there. But it's because of that, people have brought up the idea that maybe that person was lying and the suspect had nothing to do with it. Maybe the person was involved in the crime themselves. So if the DNA doesn't match that suspect, is Riverside Police willing to admit that it's not him, because then you have to explain how someone else's hair got into the hands of the victims? Or are they entertaining the idea that maybe two people were involved and that could explain why the DNA doesn't match one of them?
Yeah, I can't comment on the Riverside Police Department's handling of this case. I mean, I think you and I both know that it leaves something to be desired right from the beginning. And you'd have to ask Riverside that question. If no evidence at all points to your suspect, you know, if there's a cigarette butt that doesn't match DNA-wise, if there's a watch that doesn't match DNA-wise, and there's a hair that doesn't match DNA-wise, how long do you go on believing this is the guy? It's been 52 years. It's coming up on. So at what point do you say this wasn't the guy? And when do you just say, let's put this DNA in there and see where it actually leads us instead of assuming it's this guy? Let's put that DNA in there and see if we can find out who owns it. And then we can go to that person, if they're still alive, and question them the old-fashioned way and see if we can catch the killer that way.
Yeah, because, you know, DNA, like I said before, can be the great equalizer in a lot of cases. In the Golden State Killer, when the police went to Joseph James D'Angelo and said, you know, whatever they said, we're arresting you for murder and everything. Apparently his only response at the time was, well, I have a roast in the oven. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I didn't do it, you know, whatever. It's just like with the BTK strangler, when he tried to pretend that he was innocent until they informed him they had DNA evidence. Then he's like, okay, well, it's me. So when it comes to this case, you know, the fact that they have a suspect, the DNA doesn't match him, that means that you have to have a logical scenario in which that DNA could belong to someone other than the killer. And I don't see how that's likely. I guess it's possible, but I don't see how it's likely. And if they get further DNA and it doesn't match that person, at what point, because I think what you're referring to, my criticisms, you know, don't get me wrong, I think the people at the Riverside Police Department are good people and they want to do a good job, and I'm sure they want this case to be solved. It may just be an issue of a certain unwillingness to look at other theories, but I don't care who it turns out to be. I've been critical of them largely because they just don't seem to want to entertain the idea that Zodiac was involved, whether he just wrote the letters or whatever. But it would seem to me that after however many decades of accusing a specific individual, and time again, the evidence does not appear to implicate him. At that point, you need to turn to an alternative scenario. And the best alternative scenario right now is the Zodiac. After all, he's the only person we know of who took responsibility for the crime, right? I mean, now maybe he was lying when he did that. But at the same time, I think we need to know the answer to that question. So I would hope that, you know, they take whatever DNA they have and pursue it by any means possible. And whether there is any chance of comparing it with Zodiac DNA, I would hope that that's been done. There's been some stories that it's been done already and didn't match. I don't have any verification for that. But there's so much controversy around it that it often seems like it's a hot potato no one really wants to touch. And I don't believe that the Riverside Police Department don't want this case solved and they're obstructing or whatever, because as we know, when the History Channel did their series last year, the Riverside Police invited them in and allowed them access to some of their evidence, which was unheard of in previous years. So that demonstrates a certain willingness to explore other ideas. So I hope that they're willing to explore that to its logical conclusion. And that brings me to Ross Sullivan, that what efforts do you know of were made to investigate Ross Sullivan as a suspect in the Riverside case? And then there's some indication that Ross Sullivan's fingerprints were compared to Zodiac fingerprints and didn't match. So what do you have to add to that?
So as far as Ross originally being, you know, a suspect in Sherry's murder, you know, the library staff said this is the guy we think did it. And, you know, he supposedly had an alibi. That's what stated. I haven't seen his name in a police report that says he's ruled out by an alibi, but that's the reported way he was ruled out.
And it didn't say what the alibi was.
Yeah, it didn't. I'd have to go back and look. It's been so long since I looked at it. It's possible that it was a girl that he was staying with. He was, I think, running a room from her, or she was letting him live in her house. Mm-hmm. That may have been the source of the alibi. But one way or another, he supposedly had an alibi. So as far as the actual murder of Sherry. But, you know, again, this is how fully was that investigated? How fully was that researched? You know, if they had blinders on and they were convinced it was their pet suspect, did they go through the proper channels to rule Ross out and verify his alibi? And then to answer your question about the Ross being linked to Zodiac and being investigated, you know, a reporter, Dave Peterson, who was the one that originally got the word that Ross was suspected by the library staff in Riverside, he sort of got interested in Ross as a suspect after talking to them, and he reached out to Dave Toski at SFPD and said, can you check out this Ross Sullivan? Can you check out his prints? And, you know, what we saw when we finally saw some of this material released, there was a response that said, and you know, I don't have it right in front of me, but I think it said, Ross's prints were checked without success, I think is the way it was worded.
Yeah.
So I initially took that to mean they didn't match, but then I thought about it. I was like, it doesn't say it didn't match. It said they were checked without success. Does that mean they couldn't get them? You know, so it was a little bit vague. So that left open a possibility that, you know, maybe they just couldn't get them. Maybe he couldn't check them. And then, you know, I'm not one of those people that, you know, second guess the evidence and think, you know, like the print on Paul Stein's cab is somebody else's. I think it most likely belonged to Zodiac. So, and if it was actually Zodiac's and it was compared to Ross's and we knew that for sure, you know, I could say, okay, it's not him. But the way that memo was worded leaves a little bit of doubt in my mind.
It's confusing because it's a vague way of describing what should be something very simple.
Yeah.
And I also, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but when I remember looking at some of that stuff, it almost seemed to me like maybe they weren't sure they were talking about the right Ross Sullivan.
I'd have to go back and look because it's been so long and there's a lot of stuff breaking at the time.
Again, thank you very much for a great conversation on Zodiac.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate you appreciate you having me on. I'd be glad to do it again sometime.
Thanks, Mike.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.